my fellow narrator and friend Being Scared is about 60% done with his indie film, Gale, Yellow Brick Road, and could really use some extra help crossing the finish line. Click the link in the description below to check it out and support their community in indie horror filmmaking. Born on August 25th of 1954 in the Swiss city of Basel, Bruno Manser's childhood was one of high hopes and great privilege. He grew up in a wealthy family and was a bright, free-thinking boy. Yet despite his parents' expectations of a career in medicine, young Bruno chose a different path. At age 19, Bruno was sentenced to 3 months in prison after refusing to partake in Switzerland's compulsory military service. Inspired by the nonviolence of Mahatma Gandhi, he relished in his status as a political prisoner, and upon leaving prison, he wished only to live a simple and contented existence. From 1973 to 1983, he worked as a shepherd in the Swiss Alps, busying himself with handicrafts, herbology, and speleology, which is the study of caves and the root of the worst word in the English language, spelunking. He learned how to make, bake, and lay his own bricks. He carved leather, kept bees, and even made his own clothes by weaving the wool of the sheep he tended. And for a long time, this was enough to keep Bruno happy. But around the age of 30, he developed a deep and unshakable wanderlust. In 1984, Bruno visited the Malaysian state of Terengganu, where he joined an expedition to explore Gunung Mulu National Park. And it was here that he first learned of a nomadic tribe known as the Penan. Bruno later said he intended to find the deep essence of humanity from people who are still living close to their nature. And he set off in search of the tribe, but after a gastronomic encounter with an unripe palm heart, he found only food poisoning. Undeterred by his initial setbacks, and following many subsequent attempts, Bruno finally found the Penan nomadic tribes near the headwaters of the Limbang River in May of 1984. At first, the Penan people simply ignored him, being far too cautious of the crazy Orang Putih, or white person, to approach him. Yet after a while, the Penan found themselves impressed with Bruno's resilience, and after proving he had no ill intentions, they eventually accepted him into their villages. During his time with the Penan, Bruno mastered all manners of jungle survival skills. He familiarized himself with Penan culture, learned their language, and he was even accepted into the court of the Penan tribal leader, Chief Alang Sega. Bruno wore a loincloth while hunting with the tribe's warriors, using a blowgun and poison darts to bring down birds, primates, and even snakes when other sources of protein became scarce. Back in Switzerland, Bruno was mocked with the nickname Tarzan, with many saying that he'd finally gone and lost his mind. But among the Penan, he was known by the name Laki Penan. Laki Penan simply means Penan man. But make no mistake, this was the highest compliment they could have possibly bestowed upon him, having all but officially inducted him into the tribe. He'd survived malaria, a near-deadly snake bite, and had survived a mountain fall by hanging from a rope for just less than 24 hours. And it's quite clear that Bruno could handle himself in the jungle. But that makes what happened to him next all the more confounding. By the year 2000, Bruno had been taking prolonged trips into the rainforests of Southeast Asia for more than 15 years. He'd been heavily involved in anti-deforestation activism in the region, but had sadly made many enemies in the process. Logging firms hated him, those in need of cheap timber hated him, and due to his very vocal accusations of corruption, Malaysian politicians sought to ban him from entering their country. Bruno was forced to turn his sights onto Indonesia, and in February of the year 2000, he found himself on the jungle paths of Kalimantan, Indonesia. Bruno was accompanied by a film crew from his foundation, the Bruno Manzer Fund, as well as the organization's secretary, John Quensley. There, he split off from Quensley and the film crew and continued on his journey with another unarmed companion. The trip continued for 2 weeks, crossing mountains and rivers on foot and by boat, with only reprieve being a few hours' sleep in a canvas hammock. On May 18th, Bruno reached the Sarawak-Kalimantan border, and he and his companion spent one final night there, with Bruno writing a brief message on a postcard to his girlfriend, Charlotte, who'd remained back in Switzerland. After making him swear he'd see it delivered, Bruno gave the postcard to his companion, who later said that he seemed perfectly happy and healthy as they'd parted ways. And then after that, Bruno walked off into the jungle, alone. According to John Quensley, Bruno crossed the Sarawak-Kalimantan border on May 22nd. He was then sighted by a Penan friend, a man called Paliu, on May 25th. Paliu said Bruno was carrying a 30-kilogram backpack and was headed in the direction of a mountain named Bukit Batu Lawi. Bruno told Paliu that he intended to climb the mountain, but when asked if he wanted company or assistance, Bruno declined. Paliu wished him luck and then bid him farewell. But little did he know, it was the last time anyone would see Bruno alive. After failing to return to the Foundation's campsite in the allotted time frame, John Quensley and the camera crew enlisted the help of the Penan tribesmen in finding him. They scoured the region surrounding the Limbang River and even tracked down Bruno's final campsite before his attempt to climb Batu Lawi. They followed Bruno's machete cuts into the thick forest until the trail reached the swamp at the foot of Bukit Batu Lawi. But frustratingly, there was no trace of him in the swamp, going back from the swamp, or trace of anyone else coming into the area. Bruno's foundation paid for a search and rescue helicopter, as well as a mountaineering team to circle the limestone pinnacles of the mountain. However, citing the extreme danger of doing so, none of the mountaineers were willing to scale the last 100 meters of steep limestone that formed the peak of Batu Lawi. Following their descent, the mountaineers concluded that if Bruno had attempted to scale the limestone peaks, there was a high probability he'd suffered some kind of tragic accident. And with that in mind, they made a second journey up Batu Lawi, concentrating around the places Bruno might have landed should he have taken a nasty fall. Yet mysteriously, not a single scrape of Bruno's body, equipment, or clothing could be found. The mountaineers enlisted the help of two very experienced local guides and asked them to opine on where Bruno's body might have gotten to. They spent days searching various nooks and crannies, but after once again finding nothing, the local guides were majorly perplexed. In their opinion, if Bruno wasn't in the spots they predicted, then they had to rule out a mountaineering accident as the cause of his disappearance. If Bruno had climbed the mountain, he must have made it down alive. There were simply no other explanations for why he was no longer there, at least no rational ones anyway. Upon being informed of Bruno's disappearance, his girlfriend Charlotte got in touch with the Foundation with a crucial development. In the final postcard that he wrote to her, the one posted prior to his mountain climb, Bruno had complained of both diarrhea and a broken rib. He also complained of suffering serious fatigue, yet appeared resolute in his desire to accomplish something he neglected to detail in the postcard. Bruno appeared to be searching for something, something that had driven him into the jungles of Indonesia, alone. But what if the object of Bruno's search had been the very thing that caused others to search for him in turn? And as the search grew more desperate, Bruno's distraught companions enlisted the help of psychics, fortune tellers, and even tribal necromancers. In some cases, their exact predications differed dramatically, yet all agreed on one thing. Bruno was alive. Emboldened by their consultant's supposedly supernatural foresight, Bruno's foundation requested that the Swiss Federal Department of Foreign Affairs open up a formal inquiry into his disappearance. They agreed, and yet another search party wandered into the jungle in the hopes of bringing Bruno home. But once again, and despite vast amounts of money and man-hours being poured into the search, their efforts were fruitless, and they returned empty-handed. In November of 2001, Bruno was awarded the International Society for Human Rights Prize for Switzerland. It was an award that would have meant a great deal to a man who dedicated his life to indigenous rights. Yet just months later, he was awarded what he might have considered to be an even greater prize. In January of 2002, hundreds of Pinan tribesmen gathered to perform a funeral ceremony known as Atawai. There, they paid tribute to the missing Bruno Manzer, celebrating both his life and his courage before bidding his eternal spirit farewell. Tribal chieftains referred to him as Laki Tawang, or the one who became lost, as speaking the names of the recently deceased is a great taboo in Penan culture. After subsequent expeditions failed to uncover any trace of Bruno, a civil court in Baselstadt declared him legally dead on March 10th of 2005. 5 years later, and to mark the 10th anniversary of his disappearance, a memorial service was held for him in Basel's Elizabethan Church. Roughly 500 people were in attendance. No one called him Tarzan anymore, and only a handful of people referred to him as Bruno. Out of respect, he was Laki Tawang, a man who lost his heart to the jungles of Southeast Asia, only later to lose his life. Leah Roberts was born on July 23rd of 1976 in Durham, North Carolina. She was described as a talkative, easygoing young woman with a thick Carolinian accent and a deep love for music. By the age of 23, Leah was living a comfortable existence in Raleigh, North Carolina with her longtime friend and roommate, Nicole. But her young life had been irreparably marred by tragedy. When she was just 17, Leah's father was diagnosed with a long-term respiratory illness. Then, just 3 years later, her mother unexpectedly died of heart disease. Leah took some time off of school to recuperate from the deep and sudden grief, but upon her return in the fall of 1998, she was almost killed in a freak automobile accident. She suffered a punctured lung and shattered femur and needed a metal rod inserted throughout the entire length of the bone. Finally, in 1999, Leah's dying father slipped away during the night. She subsequently withdrew from classes again, which gave her time to help organize her father's upcoming funeral and divide his estate. But it was during this time, and potentially as a result of her grief, that Leah became increasingly interested in philosophy and spirituality. Her passion for the twin topics continued to grow, then despite returning to college in the fall of 99, she spent far more time pursuing her newfound passions than studying for her degree. She kept her grades up and kept the partying to a minimum, but then, just months before she was due to graduate, she dropped out. Her friends and family were flabbergasted, but to Leah, it made perfect sense. She didn't want her degree, she wanted to travel, and if the previous few years had taught her anything, it was never to waste a moment. Yet, unfortunately, Leah's newfound sense of wanderlust would ultimately be her undoing. On March 9th of the year 2000, Leah and her sister Kara shared a lengthy telephone call. They made plans to babysit together the following day and then also agreed to visit the homes of some mutual friends over the days that followed. Yet mysteriously, these were promises that Leah would never honor. That very same evening, she packed some clothes, grabbed her house cat, Bia, and then embarked on a 3,000-mile solo road trip across the United States. The next day, when Leah failed to arrive for their babysitting appointment, Kara simply assumed her sister had changed her mind. Leah was still feeling the loss of her father, so the change of plans caused no offense. It took until March 13th for Kara to realize something was wrong, and when she did, she drove over to her sister's apartment to check on her. Finding the front door unlocked, Kara began to search Leah's apartment. And then upon entering her bedroom, she found a notebook with the words, "Read me," scrawled on the cover. Kara picked it up, opened it, and found a handwritten note along with $3,000 cash. and the note was addressed to her roommate and read as follows. "Nicole, this is to cover bills for a while as I'm gone. Remember, everyone is together in thoughts and prayers and time passes quickly. Have faith in me, yourself. Help Shep with Easter at Lotta House for fun for the children. Give Peter my laptop. Give everyone my love. See you soon. Tell Kara don't worry, even though she will. Leah. P.S. There are ready to bake cookies in the freezer." Underneath the main body of text, Leah appeared to have scrawled several additional messages. April 23rd, one read, "On the road. No, I'm not sad. I'm the opposite. Remember Jack Kerouac? Tell Nikki I meant to come, but I had no choice." The second read, "She'll understand." The third additional message gave a friend permission to stay in her room should she ever visit Raleigh, but quite evidently it wasn't of nearly as much interest as the first two. One of Leah's favorite authors was Jack Kerouac, and she had a particular love of his work Dharma Burns. According to a close friend, she particularly enjoyed the part where Kerouac spends the summer of 1956 as a fire lookout on Desolation Peak in rural Washington State. Kara, who had been granted power of attorney over Leah, used it to obtain her sister's bank records. They showed that Leah was traveling towards Washington via the Southwest and West Coast. She was recreating Kerouac's journey. Kara soon discovered that Leah spent the night of March 10th in Lebanon, Tennessee, then had made it to Brooks, Oregon by March 13th. 9 days later, two trail runners jogging in Washington's Whatcom County made a strange discovery as they progressed along a trail. As they ran, they noticed an article of clothing hanging from a tree. A further search uncovered a second piece of clothing before their attention was drawn to a white vehicle, which lay heavily damaged at the bottom of a roadside embankment. The 1993 Jeep Cherokee was sitting along the left side of Canyon Creek Road, a little over 30 miles east of Bellingham. The exterior was heavily damaged, the windows were shattered, and the front of the Jeep was crumpled, which suggested a violent frontal collision. The ground surrounding the Jeep was strewn with clothing and loose personal belongings, including a guitar, passport, driver's license, checkbook, and several CDs. Several blankets were draped over the car's broken windows, suggesting someone had been using it for shelter from the elements. But when the two concerned joggers yelled out for the driver, only silence greeted them. An accident investigator who later arrived at the scene estimated that the Jeep must have been traveling at around 30 to 40 miles per hour to have sustained that level of exterior damage. It also flipped over several times before coming to a rest at a thicket of downed trees, upright and parallel to the road. The investigator went on to state that anyone present in the car during such a crash would have been seriously injured if not killed. Yet detectives were unable to find any evidence that someone was inside the car at the time of the crash. There were no traces of hair or blood, the seatbelt was not strained, and there was no damage consistent with someone hitting their head against the wheel or windshield. For all intent and purpose, it was as if the driver had simply evaporated while at the wheel of their car. Having been reported missing several days earlier, it was soon discovered that the owner of the Jeep had been none other than Leah Roberts. Security camera footage from a gas station back in Brooks showed her peering out of the window as a clerk rang her up, as if concerned that she was being followed. But the veracity of this theory has never been established. In the days that followed the Jeep's discovery, two search and rescue teams combed the area around it using dogs and a helicopter, but unfortunately they found no trace of Leah or her missing house cat. Search and rescue experts strongly doubted that Leah had wandered off and perished in the woods, not just because that the car was so close to the road, but because she had been in a state of moderate to severe injury following the crash. They too cited the lack of blood or seatbelt strain, with one official even theorizing that Leah had deliberately crashed the vehicle while not at the wheel in order to use it as a makeshift shelter. To him, that was the scariest scenario of all because, quite rightly, it suggested that she wasn't in her right mind. It doesn't surprise me that she would go off and try to find herself, Leah's brother Heath said, in the days following her disappearance. I was concerned about her, but I wasn't very worried until we got the phone call that they had found her car. A thorough search of the Jeep found $2,500 tucked in a pair of jeans, along with a wooden ornate box containing a ticket for a 2:10 p.m. showing of the movie American Beauty, which took place at the Bellis Fair Mall on the day that she arrived in Oregon. Yet what was of most concern to Leah's family and friends was the discovery of her mother's engagement ring, which appeared to have been abandoned along with her Jeep. Those close to Leah knew that ring was her most precious earthly possession, the one thing she treasured over all others. If she believed that she was leaving her Jeep, never to return, those close to her had absolutely no doubt that Leah would have taken it with her. Its presence in the Jeep suggested Leah had every intention of returning to collect it, in which case, what prevented her from doing so? As Washington-based law enforcement agencies put out appeals for public information, several very credible sightings were reported. An unidentified man informed detectives that he and his wife had met a young woman matching Leah's description at a gas station in Everett, about 70 miles south of Bellingham. The man went on to state that the woman seemed severely disoriented and made the rather alarming declaration that she didn't know who she was or where she lived. Naturally, detectives believed the man was trying to be of some help and began asking him additional questions regarding the bizarre encounter. However, after exhibiting an inability to answer their questions, the man hung up on the detectives and they were unable to re-establish contact due to the nature of their anonymous tip line. This is perhaps the most frustrating aspect of Leah's missing persons case. The detectives might well have spoken to someone with intimate knowledge of her whereabouts, but who might have been deliberately trying to deceive them. On March 21st of the year 2000, Leah's two siblings, Heath and Kara, drove over to Washington State to help search for her. Their first port of call was the Bellis Fair Mall, the place Leah had caught a screening of American Beauty in the hopes that someone there might recognize her. No one from the theater remembered her face, but in a restaurant called Elephant and Castle, employees said they'd spotted Leah at the bar on March 13th, happily chatting with other patrons. The day after Heath and Kara returned to North Carolina, one of the men who spoke to Leah at the restaurant heard the news about her disappearance and reached out to detectives. The man, who has never been publicly named, described her as very friendly and talkative, but that ultimately he'd watched her leave the restaurant alone. Missing person detectives later tracked down another of the bar's patrons who also described Leah as being warm and friendly. He also recalled conversing with her regarding Jack Kerouac and how he tied into her reasons for visiting Washington State. However, contrary to what the first witness said, the second patron claimed Leah left the restaurant with a man she'd referred to as Barry. The man then gave such a detailed description of Barry that authorities arranged for him to meet with a sketch artist, who created a composite drawing of the case's primary person of interest. However, detectives were never able to verify that Barry ever existed, and found it deeply suspicious that the story of the bar's second patron directly contradicted that of the first. When pressed about the inconsistencies between the two stories, the behavior of the second patron became very odd, enough that investigators began to wonder if Barry was simply a fabrication designed to mislead them. After searching Leah's car, detectives asked Kara what she wanted them to do with the vehicle. She told them to keep it, hoping that technological advances might yield more evidence in the future. In 2006, her decision paid off. When detectives Jamie Collins and Alan Smith reviewed the case file, they realized that the Jeep had not been searched as thoroughly as they previously thought. Although the interior was processed for blood, hair, and fibers, no one had thought to explore underneath the hood of the car for any evidence. When they opened up the hood, they found that the cover had been removed from the starter relay, and without the cover, someone could turn the ignition on and simply push on the starter relay, which would allow the Jeep to accelerate into the embankment on its own without anyone inside the vehicle. They also found unidentified fingerprints under the hood of the car. It appeared as though the Jeep had been tampered with, and that it would have taken someone with the knowledge of a mechanic in order to do that level of tampering to the vehicle, said Detective Smith, knowing all too well that his conclusion opened up terrifying new dimensions in the case. There was one person of interest who had such an experience, the man who said he watched Leah leave with Barry. This man, who had relocated to Canada by the time of the investigation, had previously served in the military and had extensive experience as an auto mechanic. It took 2 years to obtain fingerprints from Canadian authorities, but when they finally got them, they were disappointed to learn that there was no match. Then, in the spring of 2010, authorities obtained a DNA sample from an undisclosed item in Leah's car. They were in the process of comparing that DNA to the person of interest in 2011, but the results of this test are unknown, as to date there have been no public updates in the case. Leah's missing posters, which once plastered the state of Washington, are now weathered and tattered. Her smile now a whispered story of laughter and love. The search is over, but for those who knew Leah best, hope remains a fragile flame dancing in the heart's quiet corner, refusing to be extinguished. Because somewhere out there, beyond the reach of answers, was the silent promise that they'd never give up hope of bringing Leah home alive. On the morning of June 25th, 1983, the Marshall family woke up bright and early and made their way towards Montana's Elkhorn Mountains. Kim Marshall, a member of the Capital City Radio Club, had been invited to attend a ham radio operator's picnic in Helena National Forest, which covers around 1 million acres of west central Montana. It was a fine Saturday morning, with a clear blue summer sky, and accompanying Kim that day was his 4-year-old stepdaughter, Nylene. Nylene K. Marshall was only a few months shy of her 5th birthday, and despite being a child of divorce, was a happy and well-adjusted preschooler. Only Kim and Nylene were set on attending the operator's picnic that morning, but upon their arrival, Nylene spotted several other children playing along a shallow watercourse known as Maupin Creek. Nylene told her stepfather she wished to play with the other children, but unwilling to let his daughter play unsupervised, Kim declined. Moments later, a 13-year-old girl approached a hesitant Kim and proposed that she keep an eye on Nylene while he greeted his fellow radio enthusiasts. The teenager claimed that they had been catching frogs and offered to teach Nylene how to do the same. Kim thanked the girl, told Nylene to go with her, and then headed off to meet with friends. He was under the impression that the teenage girl would keep a vigilant watch over his young stepdaughter. But he was wrong. Upon returning to Maupin Creek, Kim found the 13-year-old girl who was supposed to have been watching Nylene, only to be told that she had gone missing. The girl told Nylene to stay by the creek, to focus on catching frogs and tadpoles and not to wander off, but it appears the little girl had taken no heed to this. What started as casual concern soon snowballed into abject panic, and as Kim began calling out his stepdaughter's name, more and more of the picnic's attendees joined the search for 4-year-old Nylene. Kim Marshall was horrified by his stepdaughter's sudden disappearance, but that horror only deepened when he became aware of the surrounding terrain. Maupin Creek was surrounded on all sides by dense forests, steep rocky cliffs, and deep, dark mine shafts that extended for miles underground. Fatal hazards awaited Nylene in all directions, causing the intensity of the search effort to ramp up dramatically. But when Kim asked a group of girls if they'd seen little Nylene, the answer they gave was enough to send Kim into a full-blown panic attack. According to the girls, little Nylene had been spotted talking to an unfamiliar man in a purple jogging suit. One of them later told police that the man had been asking them to play what he called the shadow game, whereby the children would follow his shadow wherever he went. The older children, having been thoroughly indoctrinated on the dangers of strangers, refused the strange man's request. Yet little Nylene had not been so cynical. After filing a missing persons report, Montana search and rescue teams mounted a large-scale search effort which spanned almost 1,000 square miles. At its height, and in addition to the dozens of paid professionals, the search for 4-year-old Nylene boasted nearly 3,000 civilian volunteers. Helicopter search teams scoured the area from aerial vantage points, utilizing heat-seeking technology in the hopes of pinpointing Nylene's location. Specialist canine teams were brought in to scour mine shafts, ravines, and watercourses, including that of Maupin Creek, where Nylene had been playing prior to her sudden disappearance. It said that one dog, who traced the banks of the creek after detecting Nylene's scent, came to an abrupt halt, and to many, this suggested something deeply chilling. That little Nylene had been suddenly and violently snatched from the ground before being carried off into the woods. Fearing foul play, the search and rescue teams ramped up their search efforts, scouring the surrounding hills and woodland for any sign of the missing girl. Yet just 5 days in, the region's weather took a severe turn for the worse, and officials had the search suspended until safe conditions returned. Many of the civilian volunteers carried on in the absence of professionals, braving severe weather patterns in the hopes of bringing Nylene home. Yet sadly, on the 10th day of the search, the effort's most senior official called time on the search. Volunteers were outraged that search and rescue personnel could simply pack up and walk away, especially when there was every indication that little Nylene was still out there somewhere, lost and afraid. But standard search and rescue operating procedure often states that if you haven't found a warm body within 7 to 10 days, you're looking for a cold one. "I got kids my own," said one civilian volunteer, who had tears in his eyes when he spoke to reporters. "I feel for the mom. What's happened here is terrible, just terrible." Over the months that followed, Nylene's face was displayed on billboards, milk cartons, and shopping bags. The number of an anonymous tip line was listed on all such postings, prompting tips to stream in from all over the world. Sadly, none of these tips proved fruitful, and even fewer seemed genuine, but just over 2 years after Nylene's disappearance, one such phone call would cause shockwaves among the law enforcement community. On November 27th of 1985, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children received an anonymous phone call from a man who made a terrifyingly shocking claim. The caller claimed to know for certain that Nylene had been abducted, and he knew this because he had been the one to take her. Authorities were exasperated. The man seemed to possess intimate knowledge of Nylene's disappearance, but it wasn't clear if he was genuine or was playing a very elaborate and cruel prank on those still searching for little Nylene. 2 months later, the man mailed a typewritten letter to Child Find of America, a nonprofit organization that focuses on bringing home missing children. In the letter, the man repeated his claim that he'd abducted Nylene, but referred to her only by the name Kay. Authorities were still unsure that the man's claims were genuine, at least until they read one particular paragraph included in his letter, which included several investigative details which had not been made public. The letter's author was privy to things that non-law enforcement personnel would not have access to, said a Dane County detective, Kevin Hughes. "After that, we had no choice but to consider his claims genuine and treat him as our prime suspect." The letter's author also claimed they had, and I quote, "a nice invested income." This implied his passive income allowed him to live a mostly hermetic lifestyle, by which he could dedicate himself to his lifelong passion, kidnapping children, before raising them as his own. The anonymous kidnapper, whose letters were postmarked from Madison, Wisconsin, then made the audacious claim that he enjoyed taking his victims on vacation. Apparently, after arranging a fake passport for his young abductee, they traveled all over the United States together, as well as to Canada and even the United Kingdom. He said he knew that Kay's family missed her, that he was aware he'd brought them great pain, but in any event, he could not let Kay go. She was his property now. Just months later, Child Find of America received two more letters as well as an anonymous phone call, all from the same anonymous suspect that claimed to have abducted Nylene. His previous communications had been shocking, but these new ones chilled the blood of even the most hardened detective as they made the sickening claim that little Nylene was being abused. Tim Campbell, a detective with the Jefferson County Sheriff's Department, later spoke with the press regarding what he'd seen, heard, and read. The suspect said that he was taking good care of Nylene, or Kay, whatever he was calling her, but then during the same phone call of her letter, he'd made reference to things that we considered to be serious abuse. The FBI traced the calls to several phone booths, including one near a pharmacy in Edgerton, Wisconsin, yet the calls abruptly stopped after the phone booths were located and police began analyzing them for any potential forensic evidence. 5 years later, with the search for Nylene still ongoing, the national syndicated TV show Unsolved Mysteries aired a segment on the missing girl. Somehow, the show's producers managed to obtain copies of the anonymous letters and aired excerpts of them on national TV, and they read as follows. Excerpt 1. I didn't want their person to try to get information from her. All I could tell them was that she was okay, and I hope that Child Find can get the following back to her family. I picked Kay up on the road in the Elkhorn Peak area between Helena and Boulder. She was crying and frightened, and as I held her, she was shaking, and I decided that I would keep her and love her, and I took her home with me. I have a nice investment income, and I can work from home, so I care for her myself all the time. I teach her at home, and she likes to go with me when I travel. Her hair is short and curly now, and she has really grown. She's about 45 inches and around 50 pounds. She has all four of her permanent upper and two of her lower incisors at this time, and she takes a bath and brushes her teeth every day. She eats well. Her favorite meal is pizza and cherry. Excerpt 2. She would gladly recount to you trips to San Francisco, New York, Oklahoma City, New Orleans, Nashville, Chicago, Puerto Rico, or Canada. We were even in Britain for a month last year, and she loved it. Nobody questions passports. Excerpt 3. It is, or where it comes from, sick, only that I get it from the bathroom every morning. It's actually a spoonful of my seed. It doesn't affect her physically. I have never touched her in any other way. She is a sweet little girl, and it's because of how much I have grown to love her that I realize how much her family must miss her. But she is adjusted and seems happy. She trusts me and isn't afraid. We play a lot, and she laughs when we clown around, and she smiles and acts coy when I tease her. I love her, and I have her. I just can't let her go. In conjunction with the FBI and Unsolved Mysteries, they were able to confirm that all letters and phone calls received came from the same man. Initially, the veracity of the man's claims of travel was severely in doubt, as it made very little sense for a kidnapper to risk discovery and arrest. But suddenly, the multiple sightings of Nylene, which originated from all over the country, made perfect sense. If her kidnapper was indeed audacious enough to travel with her, then each and every sighting could have been perfectly genuine. If he is in fact traveling, the show's host said, that would account for the sightings from one coast to another coast. The show's producers hoped the episode's airing would force a break in the case, and they didn't have to wait long. In August of 1991, just months after the Unsolved Mysteries episode aired, a 42-year-old Montana man named Richard James Wilson turned himself into police and made a shocking claim. He claimed to have abducted, tortured, and murdered little Nylene Marshall, along with at least one other unnamed woman. Richard Wilson had a history of mental illness and made the confession after violating parole for a previous conviction of assault against a minor. This obviously made him a prime suspect in Nylene's disappearance, and at first, police were elated at the idea of having finally closed the case. But on further questioning, Wilson's answers were found wanting. The police took him to an area east of Clancy where Wilson's claimed to have disposed of Nylene's body. He claimed he tossed it down a mine shaft, but when asked to locate the specific place of disposal, Wilson appeared completely incapable. Not only did he lack knowledge of the surrounding terrain, but the mineshaft he claimed to have used looked nothing like the description given in his confession. Law enforcement scoured the mineshaft anyways, simply to eliminate it as a site of potential corpse disposal. Yet their suspicions were confirmed when the shaft was discovered to be derelict and empty. The Jefferson County Sheriff Tom Don told journalists that Wilson's confession had to be, quote, taken with a grain of salt. He spoke of Wilson's mental illness, as well as his penchant for tall tales, before sharing news of his release due to lack of evidence. In 1995, after living in Japan for several years, the Marshall family relocated to Mexico. Kim, Nylene's stepfather, had received a job transfer. So while he stayed behind in Japan with the children, Nylene's mother, Nancy, flew to Mexico City during the summer of 95 to look for potential houses. However, it was during this trip to Mexico that the Marshalls suffered another unexpected tragedy. One morning, a housekeeper at Nancy's hotel noticed it had been a few days since anyone cleaned her room. She asked the hotel's manager to force open the door so they could perform a welfare check. What they found inside was heartbreaking. Nancy Marshall was dead. Although a Mexican coroner declared that Nancy died of natural causes, her husband and other family members were convinced that she was murdered. Kim hired a private investigator who flew down to Mexico City and conducted a thorough investigation of the events and circumstances surrounding his wife's demise. What they discovered was shocking. The Mexican coroner who did Nancy's autopsy had declared that the exact causes of death were indeterminable. Kim's private investigator discovered quite the opposite. Nancy had been found bound and gagged in her hotel room while photographs showed her corpse to be a patchwork of cuts and contusions. Her wedding ring had been stolen, along with several other items of value, and there were signs that the lock on the door to her hotel room had been violently forced open. Following Kim Marshall's indignant appeals, Mexican authorities later changed the status of Nancy's case from undetermined to under investigation. He then demanded they investigate Nancy's death as a possible homicide, at least until the U.S. State Department stepped in to lend their counsel, and Kim found himself with an almost impossible choice to make. If he continued pressuring the Mexican government to pursue his wife's killers, there's a chance her body might never be released from their custody. But if he gave up and allowed Nancy's murder to remain unsolved, her body could be released for a funeral and burial. Kim thought long and hard about it, and then just a few weeks later, Nancy Marshall's body was returned to the United States and was buried in the state of Texas following a short but heart-rending eulogy from her husband. Around the same time Nancy was being laid to rest, a nurse at a New Orleans hospital claimed to have spotted Nylene whilst on the job. She recalled how a young woman calling herself Helena had arrived at the hospital while in labor. She arrived in the company of a much older man and at first appeared strained but in high spirits. However, in private, she made a very shocking confession. The young woman told nurses that she believed that her mother's name was Nylene and that she grew up in a different county and remembered very little of her childhood. When the man returned, nurses asked him for more information about the woman's identity and medical history. He made a series of rather suspicious excuses and then forcibly removed his much younger female companion from the nurse's care and departed the hospital with her. Naturally, the hospital's staff were severely perturbed by the interaction and prompted local law enforcement to investigate. The frightened young woman was tracked down to Oklahoma City, where police asked her to submit a DNA sample. The DNA sample was cross-referenced with one of Nylene's biological father, but there was no discernible match between the two. More than 20 years later, sometime in 2018, the Find Nylene Marshall Facebook page claimed that the businesses all over Wisconsin had received handwritten letters in relation to Nylene's disappearance. A post on the group's page stated the letters were postmarked from Cincinnati, Ohio, with no return address, and were being investigated by law enforcement. "My gut tells me she's deceased," Jefferson County Sheriff Craig Doolittle told Mountain News back in 2017. Sheriff Doolittle saw law enforcement had returned many times to the site where Nileen vanished, but nothing significant has ever been found, and not one piece of evidence was ever recovered. Recently, the National Center of Missing and Exploited Children issued an age-progressed photo of Nileen showing her at 43 years old. Decades after her disappearance, authorities still receive calls with tips. Nileen remains widely discussed on crime sleuth websites and forums. And for investigators, the case is still open. Doolittle says the issue is something that they have yet to put away. Many pray Nileen is out there alive and well, and according to the letters and phone calls, there's very high probability that's true. There will always be hope. No one should stop searching for her. She may be living her life as Kay, not remembering her past or that she was abducted. In which case, all we can hope for is that Nileen, or Kay, is enjoying some degree of peace. Hey friends, thanks for listening. Click that notification bell to be alerted of all future narrations. I release new videos every Monday and Thursday at 9 p.m. EST, and there are super fun live streams on Sundays and Wednesday nights. If you got a story, be sure to submit them over at my email, letsreadsubmissions@gmail.com, and you might even hear your story featured in the next video. And if you want to support me even more, grab early access to all future narrations and bonus content over on Patreon, or click that big join button to hear about the extra perks for members of the channel. And check out the Let's Read podcast, where you can hear all of these stories in big compilations located anywhere you listen to podcasts. All links in the description below. Thanks so much, friends. And remember, you can hear Pradeep taking a shit in the background.